Good evening, everyone. Great, so I can see some of you. I'm just going to switch the screen here so I can see more of you. Oh, look at you all. Okay. Can't see everybody at once, but I'll change the screen partway through so I get to see all of your shining faces, as River said at the beginning. I'd like to welcome you to the first talk of our Mountains and Waters session. And as you all know, we're focusing on the person in the hut, because we have all been, to some degree, some more than others, experiencing solitude, experiencing our time almost as a hermit. And so we thought it'd be interesting to look at what it means to be a hermit, what it means to be alone, but also focused on practice in some way, picking various people as perhaps exemplars or people who may be able to give us some insight into what it means to live this kind of way, from China, Japan, and America. So tonight, I'm going to start way back at the beginning, as far back as the people we're going to be talking about. We're going to be to China. And I want to talk about Shertou Shichan. He was one of our ancestors in the Zen tradition. So he was born around 700 AD and is said to live until he was 90 years old. But, you know, when you look at the records, a lot of the old Zen ancestors lived to be very old, 100, 130, you know. So I think it's really just a symbol of perhaps good fortune and spiritual attainment in China to say, oh, they lived a really old age. So we need to take that with a grain of salt, or perhaps doing Zazen will allow us to all live to 100 or 130 in good health, I hope. Because it's such an old record, you know, from 700 AD, we can't know the accuracy of all the documents that talk about Shertou's life. But in his biography, it's written that he grew up near Guangzhou in southern China. And as a small child, his mother would take him to visit various Buddhist temples in the area. And one day she brought him in front of this rather impressive Buddhist image and told him to bow down to it. And she said, "This is Buddha." And he bowed. And then, as a young boy, he looked up at the image for a while and said, "This is only a human being. If he is called a Buddha, then I want to be one too." So he was perhaps spiritually rather precocious. And we know that he, as a young boy, he took the teachings of the Buddhist tradition quite much to heart. Apparently his village still practiced animal sacrifice to appease the kind of local spirits and deities that they believed was in the area. And they did this by tethering an animal to the kind of makeshift altars that were placed out in the woods. And then after a day, they'd come and slaughter the animals and offer the meat. Now, Shertou would seek out these altars in the woods, and then he would break them and release the animals. And this apparently really frustrated, as you can imagine, the village elders. But according to the biography, they were never able to stop him, even when they give him a good whopping every time they discovered that he did that. So the next, as he got a bit older, he left home, and as a teenager, he ended up practicing briefly with the sixth patriarch, Huineng, and then under a disciple of Huineng for a number of years. And eventually, of course, he became a teacher. I won't go into all the details of his life because that's not too important for us right now. But it is recorded that he is an ancestor in the lineage of four different schools of Zen, including our tradition, the Soto lineage. And yet, there is only two pieces of writing that we have today that are directly attributed to Sherto. The first one is translated in various ways, but harmony of difference and equality, merging of difference and unity. This is one that probably we're all familiar with from having chanted at various times in our Zen centers. But the other one that is a little bit more unusual, and the one we're going to be talking about today, is the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage. And we'll be chanting this every morning after our Zazen, as we did this morning, just to kind of bring us back into this idea of what it means to be a hermit. When Sherto was roughly in his middle age, he moved to South Peak Temple on South Mountain in the area of Hunan Province. And there he built a hut on a large flat stone, just to the east of the temple that he was now abbot of. And at that point, he was given the moniker, or given the name Sherto, which means stone, or more literally, stone head. Sherto, stone head. And this is pretty common in China. Often teachers would take on the name of the place they were living, or some prominent geological feature that was in the area. And maybe one reason for doing this was it made it easier for people to find them, because during the 700s, most of the Zen practitioners were tucked away in the mountains somewhere. They didn't practice very much in the cities at this point. So the temple and the rock where Sherto had built his hut are still there today. And it's interesting that during this time, and certainly afterwards, most Zen practice and training happened in monasteries or small temples. But it seems Sherto wanted to bring back the practice of living as a hermit, in addition to living in a temple. So we're going to kind of look at the poem and see what he says about this hut that he built and his life there. So this poem is also posted on the website, so I hope you had a chance to look at it before. But if not, that's okay. I'm going to be just reading a few lines and then talking about them. And as I said, we'll be chanting this every morning in our service. So in the poem, we find that Sherto has newly arrived on South Mountain, as I explained earlier, and he's living or has recently built the meditation hut, this grass-roofed hut, this hermitage. And as a hermit, Sherto has temporarily put aside all the kind of major and minor conflicts of living with others to pursue the spiritual path, simply devoted to opening up to his universal nature or his true self. In Chinese Buddhist literature, this poem is rather unique because it emphasizes the position that the wisdom is to be found within the individual, not in the monastery or on pilgrimage so much, but it is resides and lives right within us. So let's have a look at the poem here. I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. The first verse. Isn't there something kind of alluring about a hut? When I come across a hut, when hiking in the mountains, for example, to me, it creates two things. One is a sense of safety. Ah, this is a place I can take refuge. And also a sense of curiosity. I always want to see inside. And looking inside most huts on a trail, there's nothing inside. Just a crude shelter, maybe with a wooden frame for a sleeping bag or a place to hang your food out of the reach of mice. But even so, even though the interior is kind of dark and maybe kind of damp, I imagine myself living there for a while, solitary, quiet, and content. For me, the hut symbolizes a refuge from the workaday world. It's a place where our life shifts from doing to simply being. Now, Sherto was an abbot and a teacher, a busy man with many responsibilities. And I don't know exactly when he wrote this poem, but I imagine him, you know, building a simple grass hut, not too far, but not too close to the monastery. And there he takes refuge from the busyness of his monastic duties. One of the aspects that makes a refuge a true refuge, I think, and Sherto says, there is nothing of value. I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. Small, unadorned, and spare, where there's nothing of value. So that evokes the question then, if there's nothing of value, what is of value? What is important? Now, these times of COVID-19 have forced all of us to retreat to some degree from our usual busyness. And so during your time of being a quasi-hermit, what is of value? One thing about the hut. As Sherto says at the very beginning, nothing of value here, and so there's nothing to worry about. Just being is enough. And that's so unusual, isn't it? We place so much value on things outside of us. You know, just notice how you feel when you can't find your cell phone, or the car acts up, or the computer refuses to reboot, or the next Netflix app doesn't work, or when you kind of slop something on your favorite jacket or sweater. It hurts. And so these days, when we have a little more quiet and spaciousness, at least some of us do, deprived of our usual ways of busyness and our expectations of how our daily life is going to unfold, the kind of routine that we fall into, when that's now being kind of shaken some, what is unimportant? What is important and what is unimportant? In this life, the life that you live right now, what is of true value? Notice, he says, after eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. I hope all of you during this time have had some time to take some naps, to simply kind of experience your life as it is, without the to-do list, always pressing. The second part of that stanza goes, when it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it has been lived in, covered by weeds. You know, isn't life like this? We've finished a long retreat, we've done a challenging, helpful workshop, or we've read a great book on improving ourselves, resolved to perhaps drop our old patterns, or maybe we've just made up with our partner or friend over some perceived slight. Life is sweet, feeling good, and then wham! Something, maybe even rather trivial, pushes an old button, and we're back, right, in the same, or maybe slightly different, tight, dark place. Weeds in our life. Weeds appear all the time, but we don't often clearly see the weeds are just part of the human condition. Of course they're here. But instead, we react to them, trying to fix it immediately or kind of push them away. But Sherto demonstrates for us here a way of looking at life that goes against the common view. The Buddha's First Noble Truth, of course, as we all know, was there is always going to be dissatisfaction, dukkha, suffering in our life. It is always be present. Weeds are dukkha. But as any gardener knows, pulling up the weeds is a never-ending task. There will always be weeds. That's just the way it is. Sherto, in this poem, sees the weeds clearly, and in this clear seeing, he writes, "The person in the hut lives here calmly." Now for Sherto, as well as for us, of course, but obstacles and difficulties arise, and of course they need to be dealt with. But we need to see them for what they are. They're just part of this life. They're not mistakes. So Sherto doesn't rush out to pull off the many weeds off his hut, the many weeds of his life, nor is he overcome by them. He lives calmly, meeting the misfortunes of his life and probably responding as the situation calls for. But I think he's telling us here, we don't need to fix ourselves. We don't need to engage in that endless pursuit of self-improvement with the kind of shimmering goal of a beautiful life somewhere off in the far distance. Our Zen practice is not about improving. It's about fully meeting our life and releasing over and over again. The person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, he doesn't love. So Sherto tells us he doesn't cling to his ideas or stories or views, and he doesn't cling to the stories and views of others. Not pulled by the busyness of a city or town life, he lives in his hut. But more to the point, he's not drawn into the kind of cravings and desires of the average person. Sherto is challenging us here to question what our society and our culture presents as a good life. Realms worldly people love, he doesn't love. Next stanza. Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. In 10 square feet, an old man illumines forms and their nature. A great vehicle, Bodhisattva, trusts without doubt. The middling or the lowly can't help wondering, will this hut perish or not? Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. In 10 square feet, an old man illumines forms in their nature. Here, Sherto proclaims, though this hut is small, it includes the entire world. And this echoes the famous passage in the Vimalakirti Sutra, a very influential sutra in East Asia. And we won't go into detail, but just to let you know, in this sutra, Vimalakirti, as a layman, but also a great teacher with a Buddha-like wisdom, and he kind of feigns illness, and the Buddha encourages all the monks and bodhisattvas to visit him, but they're all very nervous, because Vimalakirti is a powerful teacher who kind of pulls no punches when he teaches. But eventually, Buddha convinces Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of Supreme Wisdom, to visit, along with a horde of many other Bodhisattvas and monks and nuns, and Vimalakirti miraculously transforms his apparently narrow and humble abode into a vast cosmic palace, creating enough space for everybody. So on a relative level, Shirto's hut is only 10 square feet. But on another level, perhaps another way of looking at it, it does include the entire world. Just as our life includes the entire world. Touching here the teaching of interconnectedness, of interbeing, as Thich Nhat Hanh talks about. A great vehicle bodhisattva trusts without doubt. Now, a great vehicle bodhisattva is simply a literal translation from the Mahayana of great vehicle. And this includes, as probably most of us know, the Tibetan, Chinese, Vietnamese, Korean, Japanese traditions. But he says, this bodhisattva, trust without doubt. What does the bodhisattva trust? I'd like to suggest that the bodhisattva, having looked deeply into her life, simply trusts and accepts the boundlessness and ever-flowing character of her life. I think that's what he's referring to. Just like it says in the Heart Sutra, with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajna paramita, and thus the mind is without hindrance, and without hindrance there is no fear. Illuminating the forms in their nature, as Shoto writes in his poem, we see their emptiness, or another way to say it, we see their boundlessness. All imagined hindrances are seen through. And resting in awareness, the truth of connection, of flow, of boundlessness permeates everywhere. And so then what could possibly hinder? Who could possibly be hindered? What doubts could there be? And yet, Ashurto writes, the middling or lowly can't help wondering, will this hut perish or not? Now here, middling or lowly simply refers to the average person, maybe like you and me. Will our constructed life that we have so carefully put together perish or not? It seems for much of the time, especially when we're younger, we're in a trance of immortality. And then, at other times, we are pierced by a fear of death, wondering when that will come. And although change is kind of constantly before our eyes, we still hope this body, this thing I made, will not perish. But Shirto doesn't wonder that. He writes in the next stanza, perishable or not, the original master is present, not dwelling south or north, east or west, firmly based on steadiness. It can't be surpassed. A shining window below the gray, the green pines. Jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. Perishable or not, the original master is present. Who is the original master, I wonder? I think Shirto is pointing at each of you, at each of us, at the kind of boundless self that's here in this place at this moment. The original master is always present and unconcerned with the changes and perishing of the hut? Because the original master dwells nowhere and everywhere. When we, in our practice, manage to soften our kind of self-centered and discriminating mind, notice our clinging kind of relaxes, and we become aware of what is called in the Buddhist tradition aśunyata, or emptiness, Buddha nature, boundlessness. Maybe just a whisper, maybe just a trace. But that's enough. Because, as Sherto continues, firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. A shining window below the green pines, jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. Steadiness. What is this steadiness that can't be surpassed? Uchiyama Roshi, a great contemporary Japanese Zen teacher, wrote this about it. We ordinary people always dream of gain without loss. The path beyond loss and gain is the life of the stable self that exists before the separation between subject and object. It is beyond the duality of lucky and unlucky, rich and poor, superior and inferior. If we are poor, it's fine to be poor. Right there, we can find a dignified stability. If we're sick, there too we can find a dignified stability. If we live a life with such an attitude, there is absolute stability in the Dharma no matter what conditions we experience. In our tradition, I think we cultivate this stability with Zazen. In Zazen, we gradually settle into our life as it is before the mind starts to divide up the world into likes and dislikes. I don't think our likes and dislikes vanish, really, no matter how much Zazen we do. But when we really enter into our practice, our likes and dislikes no longer push and pull us so much, and no longer rule absolute over our happiness. As Uchiyama writes, there can be a steadiness, a dignified stability, even when we're poor, even when we're sick. And maybe we have all witnessed this in our friends or someone nearby, or maybe we have found it ourselves when we are in some painful situation. There is still a dignified steadiness. So this simple abode that Sherto is describing for us, maybe on the mountainside, the light shining through the window, we see the green pines. It's really one of great simplicity. And yet, as Sherto writes, great palaces, even Trump Towers and high-end condos can't compare with this. There's no comparison because a life of practice is based on steadiness in the present moment. Here, now. Free of longing for this life to be different, we can open to a spacious contentment, perhaps, where the beauty and grace of all that is around us comes forward. As Dogen Zenji wrote, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. What are the myriad things? Maybe it's the shining window just below the green pines. Maybe it's the oak tree outside your window. Or the weeds growing up in the vegetable garden. Next stanza. Just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. Living here, he no longer works to get free. Who would proudly arrange seats, trying to entice guests? Many of the pictures of Bodhidharma, the Indian monk who brought Zen from India to China, show him meditating in a cave with his head covered. I think it was the original hoodie. Caves and huts are pretty cold in winter, and all monastics traditionally, you know, shaved their heads. So please take my word for it. If you have never shaved your head, a shaved head is a cold head, especially sitting in winter. That's what I. This mountain monk doesn't understand at all. I love this line. This is a line that Norman has repeated in various forms, and it echoes a very famous koan that probably we have all heard of before. A dialogue between Fayan and Dijang. Fayan was going on pilgrimage, and Dijang said, "Where are you going?" Dijang, by the way, is the teacher. Fayan was a student. Fayan said, "Around on pilgrimage." And Dijang said, "What's the purpose of the pilgrimage?" And Fayan said, "I don't know." And Dijang replied, "Not knowing is most intimate." I think for most of us, not knowing is really just a source of suffering. What should I wear to work? What should I tell my boss? Where should I put my investments? Should I stay in this relationship or should I get out of it? Should I say something to that person or not? We fear we will make the wrong decision, get in trouble, maybe be laughed at, or that we'll regret whatever action we're going to do. So that's the kind of not knowing that we struggle with. But there's another kind of not knowing. The not knowing that is open to possibilities, that is awake to what's happening at this moment. It's the not knowing that shifts our attention from I, me, and mine to simply, what is this? Or maybe just what? It is the not knowing of beginner's mind. Right, that famous expression that Suzuki Roshi made popular for us. And he expressed it like this. In the beginner's mind, there is no thought, I have attained something. All self-centered thoughts limit our vast mind. The beginner's mind is the mind of compassion. When our mind is compassionate, it is boundless. When our mind is compassionate, it is boundless. Maybe that's the heart of the not knowing mind. In that same stanza, the last line was, who would proudly arrange seats to entice guests? Well, that's kind of a rhetorical question, right? Sherto is asking us, what are you still trying to get from this world? Don't you have enough? The everyday world is so very seductive, right? Holding out fame, fortune, pleasure, and praise as the cause of our happiness. And so we scramble for one of those. Or maybe we scramble for all of them. But when we direct our life towards those, something is lost. Something is obscured. And really, think about it for a moment. How do you feel when those guests of fame and fortune, praise, etc., how do you feel when they don't appear? And how do you feel when they end up leaving after a short visit? Are they really worth setting out chairs for? Turn the light to shine within, then just return. The vast, inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. Meet the ancestral teachers. Be intimate with their instruction. Bind grasses to build a hut, and don't give up. So here, Lao Shurto gives us some Zazen instruction, a phrase that many of our Zen ancestors have used to describe Zazen practice. Turn awareness around and examine the mind and the heart. This practice is a deep looking. Just like looking with a strong flashlight inside an unfamiliar cellar or cave, we look with that sense of really not knowing, but kind of with a sense of curiosity, without judgment, without words, looking deeply at your life. And Dogen uses the same expression, and maybe this is where he took it from, in the Fukan Zazengi. Therefore, put aside the intellectual practice of investigating words and chasing phrases, and learn to take the backward step that turns the light and shines it inward. Body and mind of themselves will drop away, and your original face will manifest. When we study in this way, when we put into practice the instructions of the ancestral teachers, as Sherto says, we meet them. There's an expression in Chinese Zen texts: the hairs of your eyebrows entangle with the ancestors. Of course, to do that, you really need some skookum eyebrows like I've got. Of course, that simply means we become intimate with their experience. We deeply understand. And Sherto encourages us to build our practice, build our hut, and don't give up. The last stanza. Let go of 100 years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. Thousands of words and myriad interpretations are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. So with his encouragement not to give up, Sherto also asks us not to get too caught up in our ideas about what practice is. Don't try too hard. I love his advice to put aside all our ideas and views and concepts and relax. Relax completely. Like a young child, we walk open to the wonders all around us. Sherto tells us, don't hang on to the sutras. Don't hang on to the many teachings that fill the shelves of Banyan bookstores. They are not the truth. No more than this poem that we've just been talking about is the truth. All those words, all my words, are just to help us be free, to know, to really know, to deeply know the undying person in each one of us. Sherto urges us with a spacious sense of practice. Relax, but don't give up. Keep going. To know intimately this undying person, we practice returning again and again. to this skin bag, right? This body, here and now. We continue to return to the small hut of our practice. And we discover that this small hut contains the entire world. It includes the vast sky, the moon, and all the stars. So, please, fellow friends in the Dharma, for the rest of this session, let's embrace the hermit life, as Sherto describes it, letting our solitude and the stillness that we have, however much or however little, let it nourish us, because soon enough we'll return to the marketplace, just as Sherto, of course, needed to return to the monastery to take up his duties there. Thank you all for listening, and we'll do the closing chant, and then we'll move into service, right? No, I mean into the next thing.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way.